Tender is the Night, Disc 4.
So the well-to-do Americans poured through the station onto the platforms with frank new faces, intelligent, considerate, thoughtless, thought for. An occasional English face among them seemed sharp and emergent. When there were enough Americans on the platform, the first impression of their immaculacy and their money began to fade into a vague racial dusk that hindered and blinded both them and their observers. Nicole seized Dick's arms, crying, "Look!" Dick turned in time to see what took place in half a minute. At a Pullman entrance 2 cars off, a vivid scene detached itself from the tenor of many farewells. The young woman with the helmet-like hair to whom Nicole had spoken made an odd, dodging little run away from the man to whom she was talking and plunged a frantic hand into her purse. Then the sound of 2 revolver shots cracked the narrow air of the platform. Simultaneously, the engine whistled sharply, and the train began to move, momentarily dwarfing the shots in significance. Abe waved again from his window, oblivious to what had happened. But before the crowd closed in, the others had seen the shots take effect, seen the target sit down upon the platform. Only after 100 years did the train stop. Nicole, Mary, and Rosemary waited on the outskirts while Dick fought his way through. It was 5 minutes before he found them again. By this time the crowd had split into 2 sections, following respectively the man on a stretcher and the girl walking pale and firm between distraught gendarmes. "It was Maria Wallace," Dick said hurriedly. "The man she shot was an Englishman. They had an awful time finding out who, because she shot him through his identification card." They were walking quickly from the train, swayed along with the crowd. "I found out what post de police they're taking her to, so I'll go there." "But her sister lives in Paris," Nicole objected. "Why not phone her? Seems very peculiar nobody thought of that. She's married to a Frenchman, and he can do more than we can." Dick hesitated, shook his head, and started off. "Wait," Nicole cried after him. "That's foolish. How can you do any good with your French? At least I'll see they don't do anything outrageous to her." "They're certainly going to hold on to her," Nicole assured him briskly. "She did shoot the man. The best thing is to phone right away to Laura. She can do more than we can." Dick was unconvinced. Also, he was showing off for Rosemary. "You wait," said Nicole firmly, and hurried off to a telephone booth. "When Nicole takes things into her hands," he said, with affectionate irony, "there is nothing more to be done." He saw Rosemary for the first time that morning. They exchanged glances, trying to recognize the emotions of the day before. For a moment each seemed unreal to the other. Then the slow, warm hum of love began again. "You like to help everybody, don't you?" Rosemary said. "I only pretend to. Mother likes to help everybody. Of course, she can't help as many people as you do," she sighed. "Sometimes I think I'm the most selfish person in the world." For the first time, the mention of her mother annoyed rather than amused Dick. He wanted to sweep away her mother, remove the whole affair from the nursery footing upon which Rosemary persistently established it. But he realized that this impulse was a loss of control. What would become of Rosemary's urge toward him if, for even a moment, he relaxed? He saw, not without panic, that the affair was sliding to rest. It could not stand still. It must go on or go back. For the first time it occurred to him that Rosemary had her hand on the lever more authoritatively than he. Before he had thought out a course of procedure, Nicole returned. "I found Laura. It was the first news she had, and her voice kept fading away and then getting loud again, as if she was fainting and then pulling herself together. She said she knew something was going to happen this morning." "Maria ought to be with Diaghilev," said Dick, in a gentle tone. in order to bring them back to quietude. She has a nice sense of decor, not to say rhythm. Will any of us ever see a train pulling out without hearing a few shots? They bumped down the wide steel steps.
I'm sorry for the poor man, Nicole said.
Of course, that's why she talked so strange to me. She was getting ready to open fire. She laughed. Rosemary laughed, too. But they were both horrified. And both of them deeply wanted Dick to make a moral comment on the matter and not leave it to them. This wish was not entirely conscious, especially on the part of Rosemary, who was accustomed to having shell fragments of such events shriek past her head. But a totality of shock had piled up in her, too. For the moment, Dick was too shaken by the impetus of his newly recognized emotion to resolve things into the pattern of the holiday, so the women, missing something, lapsed into a vague unhappiness. Then, as if nothing had happened, the lives of the divers and their friends flowed out into the street. However, everything had happened. Abe's departure and Mary's impending departure for Salzburg this afternoon had ended the time in Paris. Or perhaps the shots, the concussions that had finished God knew what dark matter, had terminated it. The shots had entered into all their lives. Echoes of violence followed them out onto the pavement where two porters held a post-mortem beside them as they waited for a taxi.
Tu as vu le revolver? Il était très petit, vrai père, un jouet.
Mais assez puissant,
said the other porter sagely.
Tu as vu sa chemise? Assez décent pour se croire à la guerre.
In the square, as they came out, a suspended mass of gasoline exhaust cooked slowly in the July sun. It was a terrible thing. Unlike pure heat, it held no promise of rural escape, but suggested only roads choked with the same foul asthma. During their luncheon, outdoors, across from the Luxembourg Gardens, Rosemary had cramps and felt fretful and full of impatient lassitude. It was the foretaste of this that had inspired her self-accusation of selfishness in the station. Dick had no suspicion of the sharpness of the change. He was profoundly unhappy, and the subsequent increase of egotism tended momentarily to blind him to what was going on round about him, and deprive him of the long groundswell of imagination that he counted on for his judgments. After Mary North left them, accompanied by the Italian singing teacher who had joined them for coffee and was taking her to her train, Rosemary, too, stood up, bound for an engagement at her studio. Meet some officials. And oh, she proposed, if Collis Clay, that southern boy, if he comes while you're still sitting here, just tell him I couldn't wait. Tell him to call me tomorrow. Too insouciant in reaction from the late disturbance, she had assumed the privileges of a child, the result being to remind the divers of their exclusive love for their own children. Rosemary was sharply rebuked in a short passage between the women. You'd better leave the message with a waiter. Nicole's voice was stern and unmodulated. We're leaving immediately. Rosemary got it, took it without resentment. I'll let it go, then. Goodbye, you darlings. Dick asked for the check. The divers relaxed, chewing tentatively on toothpicks. Well, they said, together. He saw a flash of unhappiness on her mouth, so brief that only he would have noticed, and he could pretend not to have seen. What did Nicole think? Rosemary was one of a dozen people he had worked over in the past years. These had included a French circus clown, Abe and Mary North, a pair of dancers, a writer, a painter, a comedian from the Grand Guignol, a half-crazy pederast from the Russian ballet, a promising tenor they had staked to a year in Milan. Nicole well knew how seriously these people interpreted his interest and enthusiasm. But she realized also that, except while their children were being born, Dick had not spent a night apart from her since their marriage. On the other hand, there was a pleasingness about him that simply had to be used. Those who possessed that pleasingness had to keep their hands in and go along attaching people that they had no use to make of. Now Dick hardened himself and let minutes pass without making any gesture of confidence, any representation of constantly renewed surprise that they were one together. Collis Clay, out of the south, edged a passage between the closely packed tables and greeted the divers cavalierly. Such salutations always astonished Dick, acquaintances saying hi to them, or speaking only to one of them. He felt so intensely about people that in moments of apathy he preferred to remain concealed. That one could parade a casualness into his presence was a challenge to the key on which he lived. Collis, unaware that he was without a wedding garment, heralded his arrival with, "I reckon I'm late. The bayet has flown." Dick had to wrench something out of himself before he could forgive him for not having first complimented Nicole. She left almost immediately, and he sat with Collis, finishing the last of his wine. He rather liked Collis. He was post-war. Less difficult than most of the Southerners he had known at New Haven a decade previously. Dick listened with amusement to the conversation that accompanied the slow, profound stuffing of a pipe. In the early afternoon, children and nurses were trekking into the Luxembourg Gardens. It was the first time in months that Dick had let this part of the day out of his hands. Suddenly his blood ran cold, as he realized the content of Collis's confidential monologue. "She's not so cold as you'd probably think. I admit I thought she was cold for a long time, but she got into a jam with a friend of mine going from New York to Chicago at Easter, a boy named Hillis she thought was pretty nutsy at New Haven. She had a compartment with a cousin of mine, but she and Hillis wanted to be alone, so in the afternoon my cousin came and played cards in our compartment. Well, after about 2 hours, we went back, and there was Rosemary and Bill Hillis standing in the vestibule arguing with the conductor, Rosemary white as a sheet. Seems they locked the door and pulled down the blinds, and I guess there was some heavy stuff going on when the conductor came for the tickets and knocked on the door. They thought it was us kidding them, and wouldn't let him in at first, and when they did, he was plenty sore. He asked Hillis if that was his compartment and whether he and Rosemary were married, that they locked the door, and Hillis lost his temper trying to explain there was nothing wrong. He said the conductor had insulted Rosemary and he wanted him to fight. But that conductor could have made trouble. And believe me, I had an awful time smoothing it over." With every detail imagined, with even envy for the pair's community of misfortune in the vestibule, Dick felt a change taking place within him. Only the image of a third person, even a vanished one, entering into his relation with Rosemary was needed to throw him off his balance and send through him waves of pain, misery, desire, desperation. The vividly pictured hand on Rosemary's cheek, the quicker breath, the white excitement of the event viewed from outside, the inviolable secret warmth within. "Do you mind if I pull down the curtain? Please do. It's too light in here." Collis Clay was now speaking about fraternity politics at New Haven in the same tone, with the same emphasis. Dick had gathered that he was in love with Rosemary in some curious way Dick could not have understood. The affair with Hillis seemed to have made no emotional impression on Collis, save to give him the joyful conviction that Rosemary was human. "Bones got a wonderful crowd," he said. "We all did, as a matter of fact. New Haven's so big now, the sad thing is the men we have to leave out. Do you mind if I pull down the curtain? Please do. It's too light in here. Dick went over Paris to his bank. Writing a check, he looked along the row of men at the desks, deciding to which one he would present it for an okay. As he wrote, he engrossed himself in the material act, examining meticulously the pen, writing laboriously upon the high glass-topped desk. Once he raised glazed eyes to look toward the mail department, then glazed his spirit again by concentration upon the objects he dealt with. Still, he failed to decide to whom the check should be presented. Which man in the line would guess least of the unhappy predicament in which he found himself? And also, which one would be least likely to talk? There was Perrin, the suave New Yorker, who had asked him to luncheons at the American Club. There was Casasus, the Spaniard, with whom he usually discussed a mutual friend in spite of the fact that the friend had passed out of his life a dozen years before. There was Muchhauser, who always asked him whether he wanted to draw upon his wife's money or his own. As he entered the amount on the stub and drew two lines under it, he decided to go to Pierce, who was young and for whom he would have to put on only a small show. It was often easier to give a show than to watch one. He went to the mail desk first, as the woman who served him pushed up with her bosom a piece of paper that had nearly escaped the desk. He thought how differently women use their bodies from men. He took his letters aside to open. There was a bill for 17 psychiatric books from a German concern, a bill from Brentano's, a letter from Buffalo from his father, in a handwriting that year by year became more indecipherable. There was a card from Tommy Barbon, postmarked Fez, and bearing a facetious communication. There were letters from doctors in Zurich, both in German. A disputed bill from a plasterer in Cannes, a bill from a furniture maker, a letter from the publisher of a medical journal in Baltimore, miscellaneous announcements, and an invitation to a showing of pictures by an incipient artist. Also, there were three letters for Nicole, and a letter for Rosemary sent in his care. Do you mind if I pull down the curtain? He went toward Pierce, but he was engaged with a woman, and Dick saw with his heels that he would have to present his check to Casasus at the next desk, who was free. "How are you, Diver?" Casasus was genial. He stood up, his mustache spreading with his smile. "We were talking about Featherstone the other day, and I thought of you. He's out in California now." Dick widened his eyes and bent forward a little. "In California?" "That's what I heard." Dick held the check poised. To focus the attention of Casasus upon it, he looked toward Pierce's desk, holding the latter for a moment in a friendly eye play, conditioned by an old joke of 3 years before, when Pierce had been involved with a Lithuanian countess. Pierce played up with a grin until Casasus had authorized the check and had no further recourse to detain Dick, whom he liked, than to stand up, holding his pince-nez, and repeat, "Yes, he's in California." Meanwhile, Dick had seen that Perrin, at the head of the line of desks, was in conversation with the heavyweight champion of the world. From a side sweep of Perrin's eye, Dick saw that he was considering calling him over and introducing him, but that he finally decided against it. Cutting across the social mood of Casasus with the intensity he had accumulated at the glass desk, which is to say, he looked hard at the check, studying it, and then fixed his eyes on grave problems beyond the first marble pillar to the right of the banker's head, and made a business of shifting the cane, hat, and letters he carried, he said goodbye and went out. He had long ago purchased the doorman. His taxi sprang to the curb. "I want to go to the film's par excellence studio. It's on a little street in Passy. Go to the Muette. I'll direct you from there." He was rendered so uncertain by the events of the last 48 hours that he was not even sure of what he wanted to do. He paid off the taxi at the Muette and walked in the direction of the studio, crossing to the opposite side of the street before he came to the building. Dignified in his fine clothes, with their fine accessories, he was yet swayed and driven as an animal. Dignity could come only with an overthrowing of his past, of the effort of the last 6 years. He went briskly around the block with the fatuousness of one of Tarkington's adolescents, hurrying at the blind places lest he miss Rosemary's coming out of the studio. It was a melancholy neighborhood. Next door to the place he saw a sign, 1,000 chemises. The shirts filled the window, piled, cravatted, stuffed, or draped with shoddy grace on the showcase floor. 1,000 chemises. Count them. On either side he read Papeterie, Patisserie, Solde, Réclame, and Constance Talmage in Déjeuner du Soleil, and farther away there were more somber announcements. Vêtements ecclésiastiques, Déclaration de décès, and Pompe funèbre. Life and death. He knew that what he was now doing marked a turning point in his life. It was out of line with everything that had preceded it, even out of line with what effect he might hope to produce upon Rosemary. Rosemary saw him always as a model of correctness. His presence walking around this block was an intrusion. But Dick's necessity of behaving as he did was a projection of some submerged reality. He was compelled to walk there, or stand there, his shirt sleeve fitting his wrist, and his coat sleeve encasing his shirt sleeve like a sleeve valve, his collar molded plastically to his neck, his red hair cut exactly, his hand holding his small briefcase like a dandy, just as another man once found it necessary to stand in front of a church in Ferrara in sackcloth and ashes. Dick was paying some tribute to things unforgotten, unshriven, unexpurgated.
21. After 3/4 of an hour of standing around, he became suddenly involved in a human contact. It was just the sort of thing that was likely to happen to him when he was in the mood of not wanting to see anyone. So rigidly did he sometimes guard his exposed self-consciousness that frequently he defeated his own purposes. As an actor who underplays a part sets up a craning forward, a stimulated emotional attention in an audience, and seems to create in others an ability to bridge the gap he has left open. Similarly, we are seldom sorry for those who need and crave our pity. We reserve this for those who, by other means, make us exercise the abstract function of pity. So Dick might himself have analyzed the incident that ensued. As he paced the Rue des Sondanges, he was spoken to by a thin-faced American, perhaps 30, with an air of being scarred and a slight but sinister smile. As Dick gave him the light he requested, he placed him as one of a type of which he had been conscious since early youth, a type that loafed about tobacco stores with one elbow on the counter and watched through heaven knew what small chink of the mind the people who came in and out. Intimate to garages where he had vague business conducted in undertones, to barber shops, to the lobbies of theaters, in such places, at any rate, Dick placed him. Sometimes the face bobbed up in one of Tad's more savage cartoons. In boyhood, Dick had often thrown an uneasy glance at the dim borderland of crime on which he stood.
"How do you like Paris, buddy?"
Not waiting for an answer, the man tried to fit in his footsteps with Dick's.
"Where are you from?" he asked encouragingly.
"From Buffalo."
"I'm from San Antone, but I've been over here since the war."
"You in the army?"
"I'll say I was. 84th Division. Ever heard of that outfit?"
The man walked a little ahead of him and fixed him with eyes that were practically menacing.
"Staying in Paris a while, buddy, or just passing through?"
"Passing through.
What hotel you staying at?"
Dick had begun laughing to himself. The party had the intention of rifling his room that night. His thoughts were read, apparently, without self-consciousness.
"With a build like yours, you oughtn't to be afraid of me, buddy. There's a lot of bums around just laying for American tourists, but you needn't be afraid of me."
Becoming bored, Dick stopped walking. "I just wonder why you've got so much time to waste."
"I'm in business here in Paris."
"In what line?"
"Selling papers."
The contrast between the formidable manner and the mild profession was absurd, but the man amended it with,
"Don't worry, I made plenty money last year. 10 or 20 francs for a Sunny Times that cost 6.
He produced a newspaper clipping from a rusty wallet and passed it over to one who had become a fellow stroller. The cartoon showed a stream of Americans pouring from the gangplank of a liner freighted with gold.
200,000, spending 10 million a summer.
"What you doing out here in Passy?" His companion looked around cautiously.
"Movies," he said darkly. "They got an American studio over there, and they need guys can speak English. I'm waiting for a break."
Dick shook him off quickly and firmly. It had become apparent that Rosemary either had escaped on one of his early circuits of the block, or else had left before he came into the neighborhood. He went into the bistro on the corner, bought a lead disc, and, squeezed in an alcove between the kitchen and the foul toilet, he called the Roi Georges. He recognized Chain Stokes' tendencies in his respiration, but, like everything, the symptoms served only to turn him in toward his emotion. He gave the number of the hotel, then stood holding the phone and staring into the café. After a long while, a strange little voice said hello. "This is Dick. I had to call you." A pause from her, then, bravely and in key with his emotion, "I'm glad you did. I came to meet you at your studio. I'm out in Passy across the way from it. I thought maybe we'd ride around through the bois."
"Oh, I only stayed there a minute. I'm so sorry."
A silence. "Rosemary."
"Yes, Dick."
"Look, I'm in an extraordinary condition about you. When a child can disturb a middle-aged gent, things get difficult."
"You're not middle-aged, Dick. You're the youngest person in the world."
"Rosemary." Silence, while he stared at a shelf that held the humbler poisons of France. Bottles of Otard, Rhum St. James, Marie Brizard, Punch Orangeade, André Fernet Branco, Cherry Rocher, and Armagnac.
"Are you alone?"
"Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?" "Who do you think I'd be with?"
"That's the state I'm in. I'd like to be with you now."
Silence, then a sigh, and an answer.
"I wish you were with me now." There was the hotel room where she lay behind a telephone number, and little gusts of music wailed around her. "And 2 for tea, and me for you, and you for me alone."
There was the remembered dust of powder over her tan. When he kissed her face, it was damp around the corners of her hair. There was the flash of a white face under his own, the arc of a shoulder. "It's impossible," he said to himself. In a minute he was out in the street, marching along toward the Muette, or away from it, his small briefcase still in his hand, his gold-headed stick held at a sword-like angle. Rosemary returned to her desk and finished a letter to her mother.
"I only saw him for a little while, but I thought he was wonderful looking. I fell in love with him. Of course, I do love Dick best, but you know what I mean. He really is going to direct the picture and is leaving immediately for Hollywood, and I think we ought to leave, too. Collis Clay has been here.
I like him all right, but have not seen much of him because of the divers, who really are divine, about the nicest people I ever knew. I'm feeling not very well today, and am taking the medicine, though see no need for it. I'm not even going to try to tell you all that's happened until I see you. So when you get this letter, wire, wire, wire. Are you coming north, or shall I come south with the divers? At 6, Dick called Nicole. "Have you any special plans?" he asked. "Would you like to do something quiet, dinner at the hotel and then a play?" "Would you? I'll do whatever you want. I phoned Rosemary a while ago, and she's having dinner in her room. I think this upset all of us, don't you?" "It didn't upset me," he objected. "Darling, unless you're physically tired, let's do something. Otherwise we'll get south and spend a week wondering why we didn't see Boucher. It's better than brooding." This was a blunder, and Nicole took him up sharply. "Brooding? About what?" "About Maria Wallace." She agreed to go to a play. It was a tradition between them that they should never be too tired for anything, and they found it made the days better on the whole and put the evenings more in order. When, inevitably, their spirits flagged, they shifted the blame to the weariness and fatigue of others. Before they went out, as fine-looking a couple as could be found in Paris, they knocked softly at Rosemary's door. There was no answer. Judging that she was asleep, they walked into a warm, strident Paris night, snatching a vermouth and bitters in the shadow by Fouquet's bar. Nicole awoke late, murmuring something back into her dream before she parted her long lashes tangled with sleep. Dick's bed was empty. Only after a minute did she realize that she had been awakened by a knock at their salon door. "Entrez," she called. But there was no answer, and after a moment she slipped on a dressing gown and went to open it. A sergent de ville confronted her courteously and stepped inside the door. "Mr. Afghan North, he is here?" "What? No, he's gone to America." "When did he leave, madame?" "Yesterday morning." He shook his head and waved his forefinger at her in a quicker rhythm. "He was in Paris last night. He is registered here, but his room is not occupied. They told me I had better ask at this room." "Sounds very peculiar to me. We saw him off yesterday morning on the boat train." "Be that as it may, he has been seen here this morning. Even his carte d'identité has been seen, and there you are." "We know nothing about it," she proclaimed in amazement. He considered. He was an ill-smelling, handsome man. "You were not with him at all last night?" "But no. We have arrested a Negro. We are convinced we have at last arrested the correct Negro." "I assure you that I haven't an idea what you're talking about." "If it's the Mr. Abraham North, the one we know, well, if he was in Paris last night, we weren't aware of it." The man nodded, sucked his upper lip, convinced but disappointed. "What happened?" Nicole demanded. He showed his palms, puffing out his closed mouth. He had begun to find her attractive, and his eyes flickered at her. "What do you wish, madame? A summer affair. Mr. Afghan North was robbed, and he made a complaint. We have arrested the miscreant. Mr. Afghan should come to identify him and make the proper charges." Nicole pulled her dressing gown closer around her and dismissed him briskly. Mystified, she took a bath and dressed. By this time it was after 10, and she called Rosemary but got no answer. Then she phoned the hotel office and found that Abe had indeed registered at 6:30 this morning. His room, however, was still unoccupied. Hoping for a word from Dick, she waited in the parlor of the suite. Just as she had given up and decided to go out, the office called and announced, "Mr. Crashaw, un nègre." "On what business?" she demanded.
He says he knows you and the doctor. He says there is a Mr. Freeman into prison that is a friend of all the world. He says there is injustice and he wishes to see Mr. North before he himself is arrested.
We know nothing about it. Nicole disclaimed the whole business with a vehement clap of the receiver. Abe's bizarre reappearance made it plain to her how fatigued she was with his dissipation. Dismissing him from her mind, she went out, ran into Rosemary at the dressmaker's, and shopped with her for artificial flowers and all-colored strings of colored beads on the Rue de Rivoli. She helped Rosemary choose a diamond for her mother, and some scarfs and novel cigarette cases to take home to business associates in California. For her son, she bought Greek and Roman soldiers, a whole army of them costing over 1,000 francs. Once again they spent their money in different ways, and again Rosemary admired Nicole's method of spending. Nicole was sure that the money she spent was hers. Rosemary still thought her money was miraculously lent to her, and she must consequently be very careful of it. It was fun spending money in the sunlight of the foreign city, with healthy bodies under them that sent streams of color up to their faces, with arms and hands, legs and ankles that they stretched out confidently, reaching or stepping with the confidence of women lovely to men. When they got back to the hotel and found Dick, all bright and new in the morning, both of them had a moment of complete childish joy. He had just received a garbled telephone call from Abe, who, so it appeared, had spent the forenoon in hiding. It was one of the most extraordinary telephone conversations I've ever held. Dick had talked not only to Abe, but to a dozen others. On the phone, these supernumeraries had been typically introduced as, "Man wants to talk to you, is in the Teapot Dome. Well, he says he was in it. What is it?" "Hey, somebody, shut up. Anyhow, he was in some Chandel scandal, and he can't possibly go home. My own personal is that... My personal is he's had a..." Gulps sounded, and thereafter what the party had rested with the unknown. The phone yielded up a supplementary offer. "I thought it would appeal to you anyhow as a psychologist." The vague personality who corresponded to this statement was eventually hung on to the phone. In the sequence, he failed to appeal to Dick as a psychologist, or indeed as anything else. Abe's conversation flowed on as follows. "Hello? Well? Well, hello? Who are you? Well..." There were interpolated snorts of laughter. "Well, I'll put somebody else on the line." Sometimes Dick could hear Abe's voice, accompanied by scufflings, droppings of the receiver, faraway fragments such as, "No, I don't, Mr. North." Then a pert, decided voice had said, "If you are a friend of Mr. North, you will come down and take him away." Abe cut in, solemn and ponderous, beating it all down with an overtone of earthbound determination. "Dick, I've launched a race riot in Montmartre. I'm going over and get Freeman out of jail. If a Negro from Copenhagen that makes shoe polish—hello, can you hear me? Well, look, if anybody comes there—" Once again the receiver was a chorus of innumerable melodies. "Why are you back in Paris?" Dick demanded. "I got as far as Evreux, and I decided to take a plane back so I could compare it with Saint-Sulpice. I mean, I don't intend to bring Saint-Sulpice back to Paris. I don't even mean Baroque. I mean Saint-Germain. For God's sake, wait a minute, and I'll put the chasseur on the wire." "For God's sake, don't." "Listen, did Mary get off all right?" "Yes." "Dick, I want you to talk with a man I met here this morning, the son of a naval officer that's been to every doctor in Europe. Let me tell you about him." Dick had rung off at this point. Perhaps that was a piece of ingratitude, for he needed grist for the grinding activity of his mind. "Abe used to be so nice," Nicole told Rosemary. "So nice, long ago, when Dick and I were first married. If you had known him then, he'd come to stay with us for weeks and weeks, and we scarcely knew he was in the house. Sometimes he'd play, sometimes he'd be in a library with a muted piano, making love to it by the hour. Dick, do you remember that maid? She thought he was a ghost, and sometimes Abe used to meet her in the hall and moo at her, and it cost us a whole tea service once. But we didn't care. So much fun. So long ago. Rosemary envied them their fun, imagining a life of leisure unlike her own. She knew little of leisure, but she had the respect for it of those who have never had it. She thought of it as a resting, without realizing that the divers were as far from relaxing as she was herself.
23.
Abe North was still in the Ritz bar, where he had been since 9 in the morning. When he arrived seeking sanctuary, the windows were open and great beams were busy at pulling up the dust from smoky carpets and cushions. Chasseurs tore through the corridors, liberated and disembodied, moving for the moment in pure space. The sit-down bar for women, across from the bar proper, seemed very small. It was hard to imagine what throngs it could accommodate in the afternoon. The famous Paul, the concessionaire, had not arrived, but Claude, who was checking stock, broke off his work with no improper surprise to make Abe a pick-me-up. Abe sat on a bench against a wall. After 2 drinks, he began to feel better, so much better that he mounted to the barber's shop and was shaved. When he returned to the bar, Paul had arrived in his custom-built motor from which he had disembarked correctly at the Boulevard des Capucines. Paul liked Abe and came over to talk. "I was supposed to ship home this morning," Abe said. "I mean, yesterday morning, or whatever this is." "Why didn't you?" asked Paul. Abe considered and happened finally to a reason. "I was reading a serial in Liberty, and the next installment was due here in Paris, so if I'd sailed, I'd have missed it. Then I never would have read it."
"It must be a very good story."
"It's a terrible story." Paul arose, chuckling, and paused, leaning on the back of a chair. "If you really want to get off, Mr. North, there are friends of yours going tomorrow on the France. Mr. What is this name? And Slim Pearson. Mr. I'll think of it. Tall with a new beard. Yardley," Abe supplied. "Mr. Yardley. They're both going on the France." He was on his way to his duties, but Abe tried to detain him. "If I didn't have to go by way of Cherbourg, the baggage went that way." "Get your baggage in New York," said Paul, receding. The logic of the suggestion fitted gradually into Abe's pitch. He grew rather enthusiastic about being cared for, or rather of prolonging his state of irresponsibility. Other clients had meanwhile drifted into the bar. First came a huge Dane, whom Abe had somewhere encountered. The Dane took a seat across the room, and Abe guessed he would be there all the day, drinking, lunching, talking, or reading newspapers. He felt a desire to outstay him. At 11, the college boys began to step in, stepping gingerly lest they tear one another bag from bag. It was about then he had the chasseur telephone to the divers. By the time he was in touch with them, he was in touch also with other friends, and his hunch was to put them all on different phones at once. The result was somewhat general. From time to time his mind reverted to the fact that he ought to go over and get Freeman out of jail, but he shook off all facts as parts of the nightmare. By 1 o'clock the bar was jammed. Amidst the consequent mixture of voices, the staff of waiters functioned, pinning down their clients to the facts of drink and money. "That makes 2 stingers and 1 more. 2 martinis and 1. Nothing for you, Mr. Quarterly. That makes 3 rounds. That makes 75 francs, Mr. Quarterly. Mr. Schaefer said he had this. You had the last. I can only do what you say. Thanks very much." In the confusion, Abe had lost his seat. Now he stood gently swaying and talking to some of the people with whom he had involved himself. A terrier ran a leash around his legs, but Abe managed to extricate himself without upsetting and became the recipient of profuse apologies. Presently he was invited to lunch, but declined. It was almost Briglith, he explained, and there was something he had to do at Briglith. a little later with the exquisite manners of the alcoholic that are like the manners of a prisoner or a family servant, he said goodbye to an acquaintance, and turning around, discovered that the bar's great moment was over as precipitately as it had begun. Across from him, the Dane and his companions had ordered luncheon. Abe did likewise, but scarcely touched it. Afterwards, he just sat, happy to live in the past. The drink made past happy things contemporary with the present, as if they were still going on, contemporary even with the future, as if they were about to happen again. At 4, the chasseur approached him. "You wish to see a colored fellow of the name Jules Peterson?"
"God, how did he find me?"
"I didn't tell him you were present."
"Who did?"
Abe fell over his glasses, but recovered himself. "Says he's already been around to all the American bars and hotels.
Tell him I'm not here."
As the chasseur turned away, Abe asked, "Can he come in here?" "I'll find out." Receiving the question, Paul glanced over his shoulder. He shook his head. Then, seeing Abe, he came over. "I'm sorry, I can't allow it." Abe got himself up with an effort and went out to the Rue Cambon. 24. With his miniature leather briefcase in his hand, Richard Diver walked from the 7th arrondissement, where he left a note for Maria Wallace signed Nicole, the word with which he and Nicole had signed communications in the first days of love, to his shirtmakers, where the clerks made a fuss over him out of proportion to the money he spent. Ashamed at promising so much to these poor Englishmen, with his fine manners, his air of having the key to security, ashamed of making a tailor shift an inch of silk on his arm. Afterward he went to the bar of the Crillon and drank a small coffee and 2 fingers of gin. As he entered the hotel, the halls had seemed unnaturally bright. When he left, he realized that it was because it had already turned dark outside. It was a windy 4 o'clock night, with the leaves on the Champs-Élysées singing and failing, thin and wild. Dick turned down the Rue de Rivoli, walking 2 squares under the arcades to his bank where there was mail. Then he took a taxi and started up the Champs-Élysées through the first patter of rain, sitting alone with his love. Back at 2 o'clock in the Roi Georges corridor, the beauty of Nicole had been to the beauty of Rosemary as the beauty of Leonardo's girl was to that of the girl of an illustrator. Dick moved on through the rain, demoniac and frightened, the passions of many men inside him, and nothing simple that he could see. Rosemary opened her door, full of emotions no one else knew of. She was now what is sometimes called a little wild thing. By 24 full hours, she was not yet unified, and she was absorbed in playing around with chaos, as if her destiny were a picture puzzle, counting benefits, counting hopes, telling off Dick, Nicole, her mother, the director she met yesterday, like stops on a string of beads. When Dick knocked, she had just dressed and been watching the rain, thinking of some poem, and of full gutters in Beverly Hills. When she opened the door, she saw him as something fixed and godlike, as he had always been, as older people are to younger, rigid and unmalleable. Dick saw her with an inevitable sense of disappointment. It took him a moment to respond to the unguarded sweetness of her smile. Her body calculated to a millimeter to suggest a bud, yet guarantee a flower. He was conscious of the print of her wet foot on a rug through the bathroom door. "Miss Television," he said, with a lightness he did not feel. He put his gloves, his briefcase on the dressing table, his stick against the wall. His chin dominated the lines of pain around his mouth, forcing them up into his forehead and the corner of his eyes. like fear that cannot be shown in public.
"Come and sit on my lap, close to me," he said softly, "and let me see about your lovely mouth."
She came over and sat there, and while the dripping slowed down outside, drip, drip, she laid her lips to the beautiful, cold image she had created. Presently she kissed him several times in the mouth, her face getting big as it came up to him. He had never seen anything so dazzling as the quality of her skin. And since sometimes beauty gives back the images of one's best thoughts, he thought of his responsibility about Nicole, and of the responsibility of her being two doors down across the corridor. "The rain's over," he said. "Do you see the sun on the slate?" Rosemary stood up and leaned down and said her most sincere thing to him. "Oh, we're such actors, you and I." She went to her dresser, and the moment that she laid her comb flat against her hair, there was a slow, persistent knocking at the door. They were shocked, motionless. The knock was repeated insistently, and in the sudden realization that the door was not locked, Rosemary finished her hair with one stroke, nodded at Dick, who had quickly jerked the wrinkles out of the bed where they had been sitting, and started for the door. Dick said in quite a natural voice, not too loud, "So if you don't feel up to going out, I'll tell Nicole, and we'll have a very quiet last evening." The precautions were needless, for the situation of the parties outside the door was so harassed as to preclude any but the most fleeting judgments on matters not pertinent to themselves. Standing there was Abe, aged by several months in the last 24 hours, and a very frightened, concerned colored man whom Abe introduced as Mr. Peterson, of Stockholm. "He's in a terrible situation, and it's my fault," said Abe. "We need some good advice." "Come in our rooms," said Dick. Abe insisted that Rosemary come too, and they crossed the hall to the divers' suite. Jules Peterson, a small, respectable Negro, on the suave model that heals the Republican Party in the border states, followed. It appeared that the latter had been a legal witness to the early morning dispute in Montparnasse. He had accompanied Abe to the police station and supported his assertion that a 1,000-franc note had been seized out of his hand by a Negro whose identification was one of the points of the case. Abe and Jules Peterson, accompanied by an agent of police, returned to the bistro and too hastily identified as the criminal a Negro who, so it was established after an hour, had only entered the place after Abe left. The police had further complicated the situation by arresting the prominent Negro restaurateur Freeman, who had only drifted through the alcoholic fog at a very early stage and then vanished. The true culprit, whose case, as reported by his friends, was that he had merely commandeered a 50-franc note to pay for drinks that Abe had ordered, had only recently, and in a somewhat sinister role, reappeared upon the scene. In brief, Abe had succeeded in the space of an hour in entangling himself with the personal lives, consciences, and emotions of one Afro-European and three Afro-Americans inhabiting the French Latin Quarter. The disentanglement was not even faintly in sight, and the day had passed in an atmosphere of unfamiliar Negro faces bobbing up in unexpected places and around unexpected corners, and insistent Negro voices on the phone. In person, Abe had succeeded in evading all of them, save Jules Peterson. Peterson was rather in the position of the friendly Indian who had helped a white. The Negroes who suffered from the betrayal were not so much after Abe as after Peterson, and Peterson was very much after what protection he might get from Abe. Up in Stockholm, Peterson had failed as a small manufacturer of shoe polish, and now possessed only his formula and sufficient trade tools to fill a small box. However, his new protector had promised in the early hours to set him up in business in Versailles. Abe's former chauffeur was a shoemaker there, and Abe had handed Peterson 200 francs on account. Rosemary listened with distaste to this rigmarole. To appreciate its grotesquerie required a more robust sense of humor than hers. The little man with his portable manufactory, his insincere eyes that from time to time rolled white semicircles of panic into view, the figure of Abe, his face as blurred as the gaunt fine lines of it would permit, all this was as remote from her as sickness. "I ask only a chance in life," said Peterson, with the sort of precise yet distorted intonation peculiar to colonial countries. "My methods are simple. My formula is so good that I was drove away from Stockholm, ruined because I did not care to dispose of it." Dick regarded him politely. Interest formed, dissolved. He turned to Abe. "You go to some hotel and go to bed. After you're all straight, Mr. Peterson will come and see you."
"But don't you appreciate the mess that Peterson's in?" Abe protested.
"I shall wait in the hall," said Mr. Peterson with delicacy. "It is perhaps hard to discuss my problems in front of me."
He withdrew after a short travesty of a French bow. Abe pulled himself to his feet with the deliberation of a locomotive.
"I don't seem highly popular today."
"Popular, but not probable," Dick advised him. "My advice is to leave this hotel, by way of the bar if you want. Go to the Chambord, or if you'll need a lot of service, go over to the Majestic."
"Could I annoy you for a drink?"
"There's not a thing up here," Dick lied. Resignedly, Abe shook hands with Rosemary. He composed his face slowly, holding her hand a long time and forming sentences that did not emerge.
"You are the most... one of the most..."
She was sorry, and rather revolted at his dirty hands, but she laughed in a well-bred way, as though it were nothing unusual to her to watch a man walking in a slow dream. Often people display a curious respect for a man drunk, rather like the respect of simple races for the insane. Respect rather than fear. There is something awe-inspiring in one who has lost all inhibitions, who will do anything. Of course, we make him pay afterward for his moment of superiority, his moment of impressiveness. Abe turned to Dick with a last appeal.
"If I go to a hotel and get all steamed and curry-combed and sleep a while and fight off these Senegalese, could I come and spend the evening by the fireside?"
Dick nodded at him, less in agreement than in mockery, and said, "You have a high opinion of your current capacities."
"I bet if Nicole was here, she'd let me come back."
"All right." Dick went to a trunk tray and brought a box to the central table. Inside were innumerable cardboard letters. "You can come if you want to play anagrams." Abe eyed the contents of the box with physical revulsion, as though he had been asked to eat them like oats.
"What are anagrams? Haven't I had enough strange—"
"It's a quiet game. You spell words with them, any word except alcohol."
"I bet you can spell alcohol." Abe plunged his hand among the counters. "Can I come back if I can spell alcohol?"
"You can come back if you want to play anagrams." Abe shook his head resignedly.
"If you're in that frame of mind, there's no use. I'd just be in the way."
He waved his finger reproachfully at Dick.
"But remember what George III said, that if Grant was drunk, he wished he would bite the other generals."
With a last desperate glance at Rosemary from the golden corners of his eyes, he went out. To his relief, Peterson was no longer in the corridor. Feeling lost and homeless, he went back to ask Paul the name of that boat.
This ends Disc 4.